Hi, everybody. Guess who it is? It's me, Keith. I just want to quickly say a thing about the Patreon effort that is going on. If you don't know, this show is funded through Patreon.com. I have an account there that is now just over $100. We've just hit that threshold, which is really great. And that allows me to, that actually pays for just the hosting of this show. The Patreon account also supports my article writing, video production, game design, and development of actually, my games. And so if the kind of stuff that I'm working on is something that you want to support, I would really appreciate if you would come by the Patreon or just take a look and see if you could maybe donate like a dollar or something to it. It really makes a big difference. And I should mention that I have a Kickstarter that's running right now for Push the Lane, my new game. If you haven't checked it out yet, the link will be in the show notes. I hope you do check that out. And in either case, the Patreon or the Kickstarter, if you don't have money to actually donate yourself, you can help me out a ton by just spreading the link, just tweeting about it or posting about it on a forum that you use or anything like that, social media. So I just wanted to say about that really quickly, and please enjoy this show. Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. Today's episode is an interview with Ty Kelly, who you probably know if you listen to this podcast already from his work at whatgamesare.com. He also writes for a bunch of other websites, and you've certainly seen his work around. And but I wanted to ask him a bunch of stuff like what does he think happened to all these game design writers that from around 2011, 2012. Where did those people go? Because there's been sort of this fall off. I've talked about this on past episodes with other guests. And Ty actually had really a lot to say about that topic and some of the most insightful thoughts on that topic that I've heard to date. So I'm really excited about that. At the end of the podcast, we also fight a little bit. Not fight, but I give my not fight even a little bit, but we discuss the merits of virtual reality and my concerns with VR. And we didn't really get into AR, although my problems with VR are only maybe even worse when it comes to AR. But anyway, I think that you'll like this. We also get into just his background, where he comes from, how he got into writing about game design. So I'm really happy with how it went, and I think you will enjoy it. So without further ado, here is the interview with Ty Kelly. I wanted to have you on the show for a while because you are, when I think about, online bloggers and people writing about game design and talking about it, consistently. And I think you're one of the top names that kind of comes up. And so I want to ask you about how you got into what brought you to writing about games in the first place?
I think the first time I really sort of got into it was about 10 years ago. I used to work in a studio in the UK named Climax. This was after I worked at Lionhead for a while. And just, I don't know, I was very interested in blogging generally, and I was kind of watching what a couple of other people were writing about in the area. And so I kicked off just a Blogspot blog called Particle Blog. And I would write to it every once in a while. Generally, in fairness, if you, it's kind of one of those things where I look back on some of the articles and I'm like, oh my God,
Yeah,
I
I
should have
had the
edited
same
that.
thing. Yeah.
Right. But that was kind of the seed. That was sort of, I guess, the beginning of like trying to sort of be a kind of a published or a public-ish sort of figure to talk about some ideas that I had. And then, so I kind of actively wrote particle blog articles for about maybe a year, maybe two. And then I kind of let it go. And then about 3 years later, give or take, this is all a little hazy in my memory now, but about three, 4 years later, I was running a startup in London at the time. We were kind of trying to get into the social game space. And I, as part of that, wrote an article on Gamma Sutra, called Zynga and the End of the Beginning, mm-hmm. where I was talking a lot about what I sort of saw going on in the social game space, particularly at the time, and the like what the patterns that seemed to be going around Zynga in particular, not to sort of pick on them, but nonetheless were. And my thesis at the time was that essentially the kind of game that they had created, the kind of, if you like, game format that they had created was too thin, and it was reliant a lot on novel users, like people who just hadn't ever encountered games on Facebook before, and it would eventually burn through. Mm-hmm. And I made some predictions that were completely wrong. Like I said, I thought Facebook would tap up at about 500 million users or so. I heard today that apparently it's close to 2 billion, so my bad. But actually, the article got a huge amount of play, and I got a lot of people contacting me saying that, like, they would disagree about some of the specifics, and that's fair enough, but that the general analysis really sort of spoke to something, and they really liked the what I had to say and all that sort of stuff. And so I kind of thought about that for a little while I continued to run this startup, and I started doing some consulting work. Some people approached me off the back of that article. And I got some contract work going, which was useful. It was helpful to bridge the gaps because the startup itself wasn't going all that well. And then I think about 9 months later, I decided to try kind of properly to create like a kind of an online proper web presence rather than kind of just articles from time to time. Mm-hmm. And that's where What Games Are sort of came out of. The name was one that I had in my head for a while because it was one of these where you literally, sometimes you think of a neat name for something. Mm-hmm. You go online, you go to like a domain registry, and you're like, oh my God, that's available?
Yeah, sure, yeah, totally.
So I'd registered it, and I had, at the time, I was sort of making a half attempt to write, my first attempt to write a book. And somewhere between those two ideas gelled together, and I thought, actually, this should be a blog. I should get some of these ideas out into the world.
What year was that you started What Games Are?
That is a good question. I think, if I look back on the site, I think it was either 2011 or 2012.
That sounds like that would have been my guess, so yeah.
Yeah, yeah, thereabouts. And I suck at dates. And I launched that fairly innocuously. I had a bit of a Twitter following, so, but not much. And I just started posting really regularly to it, just different ideas, some very short articles. I was trying to figure out the kind of pace that I liked. Some very short articles, some quite long articles. It really took off when I posted a 4 or 5 part analysis of Cityville, which was kind of the big game of the day. I basically just did a kind of a breakdown of, like, not criticizing it, but just literally kind of explaining what it was. Like, mm-hmm. what are the various parts doing? You know, that kind of thing. And why does it have this currency? What is that building for? That kind of thing. And then from there, that actually mushroomed pretty quickly. And I started getting a lot of people kind of picking up and taking interest. And within about 6 months, Edge magazine in the UK approached me about writing a column. And then another piece that I wrote about a year later, again, ironically about Zynga, seemed to be like a very interesting touch point subject at the time. Mm-hmm. But that got cross-posted on to TechCrunch and went gangbusters. And then Eric and I at TechCrunch, we said, well, how about, would you want to do a weekly column there or something as well?
Sure.
And so that was kind of the initial sort of part of it. Like in that first year particularly, I wrote hundreds of articles.
Yeah.
And then it tailed off a little bit in the second year, but it kept going very strongly. It tailed off quite significantly after I moved to the US. Mm-hmm. Because I started working full-time at a studio here as a creative director, and that takes a lot of your mental RAM up. And also because I'd started properly kind of working on a book and stuff like that.
I want to ask you about that book, but first I kind of, yeah, like, sure. So we mentioned that, like, you started What Games Are in like around 2011, 2012, and I have this sort of building theory that, like, there was this big bump of game design writing around that time, and yeah. Then, you know, 2014, 15, and 16, it like really like died off. Like, so many of the big writers that you think about as like game design theory writers either completely stopped, or they wrote like one article a year, or they're doing something else. And so, you know, I've been trying recently to like kind of like start up a new, you know, I've just random people on the game design subreddit and some people in my community trying to get people to like you know, get this sort of thing going again. But do you have any idea as to why, you know, why did it take off around 2011, 2012? Was it related to the Facebook games, really? Or was so it?
I think it's a couple of things. I think, yeah, there was a big surge of new interest in the industry generally from around 2008, 2009 onwards. And a lot of it was driven by social games, and a lot of it was driven by, like, the kind of the theory, as if you like, or the projectional idea about what this might turn into. And mobile gaming similarly kind of came in pretty much alongside that, and it led to a lot of just new thinking. And there was a period very much of sort of new school, old school, where, like, if you were perceived as being like somebody working in the PC or console industry, like, you probably had a lot of legacy thinking, whereas a lot of people who were very emergent in the new space, they really wanted to kind of draw a line under a lot of their original ideas and kind of create room for new ideas.
Right.
At the same time, it also brought in a lot of people from diverse backgrounds. So a lot of the more critical, if you like, pieces and stuff came from, like, non-traditional voices. I mean, I think of people like Maddie Bryce, for example, who I love, and who, like, really would bring, like, some very different perspectives to like classic game problems. So, like, very much kind of going beyond, like, your sort of straightforward, like, production problem design article, or your straightforward, like, abstract theory of kind of formal functions kind of design article, which tends to be, like, most design articles tend to be one or the other. And so, yeah, so it, like, that brought a lot of energy with it. I think also just the general appearance of social networks really helped to fuel it. So, like, you had on Twitter particularly, you had a really vibrant community of people just discovering each other.
Right.
And whether they were journalists, writers, bloggers, people who worked in the industry, people who were academics, people, you know, like, all of that kind of morass of people, you just had a lot of really interesting, like, voices and kind of sharing of voices going on, and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then I think what my personal impression of what kind of caused the tail off would have been two things. One was, and the industry does this a lot, like, when you get a new format of game kind of emerge, like, there will tend to be a lot of a surge of new thinking and a surge of just new reconsideration, a lot of redefinition of language, a lot of, you know, like, maybe argument through equivocation to try and make a, like, a point about how the future will be. Mm-hmm. But, like, a lot of it is actually quite noble. And you might get a bit of sort of, it might be a bit salesy as well. You might get some people who are, like, pitching a consultancy company, for instance, so they're trying to, like, get an idea out there. And I've done this just the same as everybody else. So, and that kind of thing. But they do tend to go into fallow periods afterwards when, say, maybe the patterns that have been hoped for didn't quite work out. I mean, social games is a really good case in point. A lot of the energy, I think, around the writing of social games would have been about the potential for social connection, the potential for, you know, emergent effects of like player populations and all that sort of stuff.
Sure.
But actually, like, in real terms, a lot of the games never actually went there, and they never really did that. A lot of the big successful social games at the time were essentially just kind of single player thin games. And same with mobile. It's like very similar, like, as the innovation kind of petered out and the business sort of, like, reasserts itself to an extent, things tend to go formulaic, and it's hard to keep that conversation going. I mean, there's only so many ways you can talk about free-to-play economics without just sort of repeating yourself, you know?
Right, right. So it was more of a special time, a thing of that time, than waxing, you know, a waxing and waning of, like, you know, right, talking about the same kinds of topics, right?
Exactly. And I think, we should talk about this in a bit, but I think that the current rage around new formats, like a lot of things to do with virtual reality, augmented reality, and, like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, I think I very much feel that that's going to spur off a whole new generation of conversation probably next year. But, you know, because there's a lot of studios making games, and now there's a lot of new discovery coming in. There's a lot of rethinking of language. Like, Michael Abrash a couple of years ago introduced the term presence, and suddenly actually 100,000 people everywhere are talking about presence and all that sort of thing. So it's very, like, the linguistic cycle is quite important to pay attention to. But to go back for a sec, the other reason I think that a lot of design writing fell off was Gamergate. I think because a lot of the like, whatever your individual listener's view on that might have been, I've written a lot of very strong anti-Gamergate articles because it really annoyed the hell out of me.
But, sure. I'm with you on that, for the record.
Right. but I didn't, I wasn't really like a target of it, but I know a lot of people who were, mm-hmm. and a lot of those people were some of the best writers in the space. And I mean, to be honest, like a lot of them would just be like, you know what, this is really not worth my time. Like with this kind of backlash, this kind of anger.
Yeah.
And also this kind of like, independent of the politics, if we can go there for a moment.
Sure.
On a critical level, I think Gamergate really tried to reassert consumerist values, and they really tried to reassert a very functional way of looking at the product.
A very conservative way, whereas that thing that you were talking about before was like this very kind of like, let's look at things from a new way, people from an outside perspective, people who aren't necessarily like white dudes, you know, like having a voice.
Yeah.
And so they're sort of the pulling it back into this consumer, traditional kind of video gamey thing. Yeah,
exactly. And again, whatever your individual views on that, like that definitely had a cooling effect on the overall essay landscape.
Right.
And so like a lot of people, myself included, it was definitely a period of time there where you would feel like, well, I'm really screaming into the void here. So like, maybe I just won't for a while.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing.
Sure.
So yeah, that's my kind of take on it anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I was thinking about that. I wonder if, in a way, it actually had a little bit of a cooling effect on me and other people who write about very systems, sort of apolitical writing, because the other effect that it sort of had was that it felt like the conversation about video games, like the stuff that people wanted to talk about were just political issues, I think are important and everything, but I did feel like, oh, well, you know, who wants to really read an article about, like, I don't know, randomness or something when, you know, this other like way sexier topic is happening at the same time that everyone's talking about.
That's it. I mean, and there was, I mean, I accidentally strayed into, well, no, I didn't. That's not true. I strayed on purpose into into one of those areas where at the time, this was pre Gamergate itself. But at the time, there was a lot of brewing tension around, I guess, different sort of sides of the debate. And a couple of people like Raph,
Koster.
Got sort of somewhat caught like blindsided by some of this kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt at a certain point a certain need to sort of speak out against, like, I guess, a certain level of being what I perceived as being kind of unfair tagging, mm-hmm. or that kind of thing. But to be honest, I mean, that was an article called Formalists and Zinesters.
Mm-hmm.
But that was a storm in a teacup, and I got a little bit of kind of backlash from it, but it was fine. But that was a storm in a teacup and nothing at all to compare to the flip on the other side that went when all the Gamergate stuff happened. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think it just really had that negative effect. The third thing I would say, sorry, I know I said two, but there are actually three.
That's okay.
The third thing is one of the more subtle distribution mechanisms around blogs has actually died off a lot in the last few years. And that's, of course, RSS feeds.
Hmm.
And also just generally like that new enthusiasm that you get in social networks, that we got at a certain time in social networks, like Twitter and Facebook and a couple of other networks, like they've constrained their reach quite deliberately over the last few years. And so, for example, if you, I have 7,500 Twitter followers, but if I look through my analytics on Twitter, most of the tweets that I post, whether they're links or not, they might actually only get seen by 300 people, that mm-hmm. kind of area. And I think it's a purely anecdotal perception on my part, but I think that had a fairly downward effect on the ability of new material to move around. So like, when I first was columning at TechCrunch about 5 years ago, 4 years ago, every article that I would post, like I would see them, I'd see tons of retweets kind of come out. I'd actually get a lot of people kind of follow. I mean, sure, half of them are bots, but whatever. But like, there'd just be a lot of activity, you know,
there'd be a lot of
just sort of like very noticeable sort of social activity kind of happening around pieces. And that's great. And then I noticed about 2 years ago, before I suspended my column for a while, that really had stopped. Like that kind of level of engagement really hadn't been sort of true platform wide for a while. And at first I thought maybe as has my writing gone terrible, but I don't think so. I mean, it's hard. I could see, I had other indicators that told me like that readership were still like just fine, but clearly the sort of sharing behaviors or that sort of stuff, I think went through and has gone through a pretty kind of downward
That's really interesting. I had a similar thought where, because I used to write a lot of stuff that would just like make people really angry. Like I would criticize modern games that are really popular. And so I used to get lots of feedback, you know, back 2012, 13. And so like lots of feedback, usually very strongly worded negative feedback. And recently I've stopped, like I don't really get that at all. And I was like, part of it's like I'm not as critical and I'm not as like, you know, kind of just fire breathing. But and so I thought that that might be it. But it's interesting to think that there might also be these structural reasons as well. And I would like you mentioned something about RSS being not. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, RSS technology obviously is still there. But Google killed off Google Reader a few years
back. I remember that. Yeah.
Google Reader was like that was a major, major, major thing. And for a certain kind of user who likes long form content, Google Reader was probably like the main kind of place to go. Bloglines maybe and a couple of others, but really Google Reader was the main one. When Google decided they wanted to go, do you remember all that stuff at Plus and they wanted to kind of become like et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
They still have Plus, so, don't they?
I guess, but it's kind of a zombie social, zombie network. But the like it had a very, very, very chilling effect on how long form discourse kind of gets passed around.
Interesting.
And like it's been replaced somewhat these days by things like Apple's news app on iOS, which is actually much better than people realize it is, or Flipboard or stuff like that. But they're much more managed experiences, and they tend to. In a user experience design sort of way, they tend to surface for very popular articles only or that kind of thing. It's actually hard to get kind of deep content out of them. And similarly with sites like Medium, I think it's a great platform for a lot of reasons, but Medium, in my experience, it's quite hard to sort of find deep content within it. You know, it doesn't really respect a long form reading particularly well. So, the fourth thing, I said there was three, but there's actually four. I just keep thinking of
I'm glad I asked.
Of course, one of the last things, of course, is the same during the same period, we've seen the rise of video voices as opposed to textual voices, particularly obviously with YouTube and Twitch. And if you actually go online, like you can find a lot of, I mean, some of them are pretty consumery, some of them are a bit more intellectual, like whatever. But you'll find there's actually a ton of voices, a ton of like, highly watched individuals out there who are, some of whom are trying to have like interesting observations about games, some of whom are just kind of doing the fanboy thing, and some of whom are trying to like help popularize games and kind of everything in between, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it might be to an extent for guys like yourself and myself who are used to the more essayish format.
Yeah.
Maybe the thing is we need to get good at video. Maybe like actually what we need to do is like make, construct video essays. Rather than writing essays,
you know,
maybe it's that kind of thing. Some combination of key points or what is it, PowerPoint slides and video segments, and you know it's more production work.
But sure.
It seems like those. If you look at the analytics behind how messages on those platforms spread, it's at least 100-fold spread compared to basically any. Written content that I've ever seen.
So. Right, right. That's a good point. And I think podcasts may also sort of fall into that category. It seems like podcasts have definitely been on the uptick, right?
They do seem to be having a resurgence, which is great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's cool. That's a good piece of advice. And it is pretty reasonable if you're an article writer to convert that into, you know, some kind of simple video just with slides and stuff. So, yeah, that's good thinking. So I guess let's talk about your book next. What can you say about your book that you're working on?
My infinite book. 4 years ago, 5 years ago actually, I was approached by an editor, a really nice guy named Sean Connolly.
Oh, I know Sean Connolly. He's my publisher too. Yeah.
Yeah.
At Focal, right?
Yeah. I think their name has changed a couple of times since, but yes.
Yeah.
And so Sean approached me with the idea, because he had run across a lot of my stuff, and he approached me with the kind of loose idea to create some sort of design book, and we refined that for a while. I talked about maybe trying to write a book that would be a more pragmatic game design book than some are, with without taking anything away from other game design books, and I'm kind of nailing on a lot of those sorts of issues. And yeah, and so we you know, we negotiated a deal and stuff, and I agreed that I would try and do it relatively quickly, maybe in about a year, give or take, and that was the plan. And 3.5-4 years later, I'm still working on it. Because it's so, like, the thing of it is that books, what I discovered very quickly once I actually put my head into it and once I've actually sort of tried to write this kind of book, is it's particularly if you're trying to write one that's relatively accessible and relatively short. I'm aiming for about, say, 300, 350 pages, thereabouts. There's a huge amount of what goes in, what goes out, what's important, what's not.
Editing.
I've rewritten so much of it so often. So, and I feel good about it every time I do. But at the same time, I mean, it's pretty long-winded.
Sure. Yeah.
Kind of process. But the actual subject, and also the subject matter itself. So the book is actually called Core Game Design, and it's all about. It has essentially three sort of subtopics, but in general kind of principle, it's all about the game design process. It's all about the abstract mechanical part, if you like, of game development. So not the technology, not how to use Unity or Unreal or how to script or that kind of thing. Not about art, not about visuals, not about any of those kinds of things. It's the bit in the middle. It's the bit that you and I know full well that and that guys like Raph and Dan Cook and a bunch of others have talked about it in that way.
So hold on. In other words, you're telling me that you're writing a book about game design and it's actually about game design?
I am, in fact, writing a book about game design, which is about game design.
Wow. Nice.
So it has three parts. The first part is, because one of the things that I discovered quickly about trying to write this book is there's an element of unlearning as well as learning. So I've had the advantage, as being a consultant across with dozens of studios over the years, I've had the advantage of seeing many different sectors of the industry and seeing how a lot of their individual, if you like, internal logic works. And in so doing, what I've seen is that actually there's a lot of very similar patterns across a lot of different companies. But they often use very different language to actually kind of express themselves. And they also tend to have a really bad habit of thinking that the sector that they work in is, quote unquote, the games industry and that everything else is not really, or some sort of combination of that. And so the first part of the book, the book is basically split into three subtopics. The first one is called Problems. The second one is Principles, and the third one is Practices. So Problems actually focuses a lot on why is it so hard to design a game? And why is it that a lot of studio culture actually tends to lead to very bad design outcomes? And third, what is the role of a designer? Well, first of all, what is the theoretical role of a designer supposed to have been if you read a lot of stuff? But in real terms, what's the actual role of a designer?
Right.
Why does basically probably everybody need to rethink that? So that's a huge chunk. And I talk a lot about individual skills that are required, and I talk a lot about the kind of impediments and how actually most of what surfaces again and again is what I would call a hard problem. So a hard problem, like an NP hard problem, a problem that's essentially difficult to express in the first place. And so as a result tends to only get solved by a lot of doing rather than a lot of kind of, you know, infinite description of that sort of stuff. So that's part one. Part two, Principles, then is about what is a mechanic, what is a game controller, what is a rule, what is a system, what is an economy. It's a very like rough guide to every single part of game design, at least as I understand it and what I've run across in my career and what I've read. Everything from player models through to, you know, systemic approaches through to, I touch on a bit of game grammar, for instance, and stuff like that.
But I'm trying,
it tries to sort of keep it relatively user-friendly. So I feel like a lot of it is, in writing the book, I feel like a lot of it is not necessarily exploring brand new territory, but maybe just trying to sort of make it accessible that non you know, game design blog readers like ourselves could actually like get value from it.
Yeah, I wanted to react a little bit to that, the thing of like, you know, having these terms and sort of like redefining them and all that kind of stuff. And because I think there's a lot of resistance to that sort of an effort. And I, at the same time, I feel like every game design book I've ever read does have some degree of like, you know, offering definitions that are to some extent redefinitions, you know, that are but my thing is like, we shouldn't be afraid of that. Like, that's part of the process. Like, this constant evolution of, like, you know, new people, like seeing, like you said, people are sort of, they're seeing patterns, and they're all kind of seeing them, but they're using different words. I mean, this is part of how we build the discipline. So I just think, you know, some people, like, they're like, oh, here we go, another definition of whatever. But I think that's really just, like, doesn't help us to have that attitude.
So my kind of thing is I kind of half and half on that. So one of the things that I did at What Games Are several years ago was I attempted to do that. I attempted to put together
Looking at your glossary.
Yeah. And like that was just a huge effort, and a lot of some of those individual pages, if I look at my site's analytics, they get sort of picked up a lot, but it's kind of a random spread. It's not there isn't necessarily a great readership for it, but it's more like somebody discovered the site when they were doing a Google to try and find out what a Ludin is. And for some reason, my site turns up top of that list. Mm-hmm. And somebody did a search to try and find out what a vertical slice is. And same thing, for some reason, my definition would turn up top of the list, that kind of stuff. So it's pretty patchwork. But what the realization I've sort of come to over the years is I think the language process of games will always move. I think it will always be mutable. I think there's never a time when we won't actually get away from somebody having a new idea about what a game mechanic is, right? Or somebody recasting what they think the dynamism in game is, or somebody coming up with a new diagram to sort of explain what the kind of internal chaotic model of a loop is, or something like that, right? There's always going to be new analogies, and there's always going to be new ways of what might feel like saying the same things. And at the same time, there's never going to be, I believe there's never, ever, ever going to be consensus, because you get with certain large ideas, because you get there's too many individual, essentially philosophical schools around games that have just fundamentally different views of like what games are supposed to be. Mm-hmm. And those schools, whenever these big definitional arguments come up, those schools, they basically end up arguing against one another all the time. So like your classic gameplay versus story debate, like that's one that just people come up with different names for it over the years, and then they discard them in disgust and that kind of thing, and then they kind of come up again and sort of back and forth. I wrote an article, for example, about 5 years ago, I think 6 years ago, called The Four Lenses of Game Making, where I identified sort of four completely different schools and ways of thinking. This was brought out of I was very unsatisfied with that duopoly. I thought what actually tends to happen is there's some games would fit in the like the highly mechanical kind of end, the some games that would fit in the highly like story end, and then the great majority of games would end up sitting somewhere in the middle of this, which meant nothing. It just didn't really tell the reader anything about anything other than games have a bit of this and a bit of that, and and so I thought about it in terms of, okay, so on your gameplay versus story kind of axis, you have a clear difference between like very emergent uses and very experienced uses, right? The experienced uses, I want the player to have this exact thing happen to them and to feel these emotions. Whereas the emergent use is something like Minecraft. I just want to make a big toy set and I want them to play and figure it out for himself. Mm-hmm. And then I looked at, the other axis I looked at was abstraction. So how much is a game attempting to paint a realistic world not realistic, sorry, that's the wrong word. A very, like a high fidelity world. Like something that was a lot of detail and there's a lot of like attempt to like fold fiction in there and fold like character and all that sort of stuff versus the highly abstract games, you know, like a crossword puzzle would be the highly, highly, highly abstract.
Yeah.
Whereas Mass Effect would be the highly, highly, highly fictional kind of idea.
Okay.
And the result was, like every designer since the dawn of time, I came up with a quadrant graph. Mm-hmm. But my quadrant was it's had a few different names over the years, but my quadrants basically turned into, there's games that are really about mechanics, there's games that are really about story, there's games that are really about simulation, and then there's games that are really about behavior. Mm-hmm. And I found that very useful, and some people have come back to me and say, that's a really useful idea. Like, it helps to sort of sort out a lot of confusion. But again, it's not necessarily been widely picked up. I see recently, as a lot of VR games are coming through, actually a lot of should VR games have gameplay or should they have story? Like, that whole thing is coming back again. Mm-hmm. And you can just sense a year from now, there'll be new terms that are essentially trying to place everything on a single line axis again, because people like a kind of left, right, good, bad, mm-hmm. Black, white, whatever, sort of schema, you know, they understand it.
Yeah, there's one little thing that you said that I want to push back on a little bit, and maybe, which is just that the idea that, you know, I agree that we're always going to be redefining and coming up with new charts and new ways to explain stuff. You know, that search is never going to end, but I think that people could be mistaken by that into thinking that no progress will be made, and that, like, maybe there will never be 100% consensus, but there will be an increasing consensus as we learn more. There's actually something to learn there, and I think some people sort of think that, and I just wanted to clarify and make sure that that maybe, I don't know if this is what you're saying, but some people think that there kind of isn't anything to learn there, and that we're just kind of going to be on this endless treadmill of, like, say, if having these same fights over and over and over again forever.
So what I would say there is, I think there's going to be my personal impression is, because it's tied up in feelings, there's a couple of kind of tentpole, if you like, axioms that are never going to change, or at least certainly in my lifetime, I don't expect them to. And one of those, for example, is these endless quests of trying to define what a game is. That's just something that no matter which way you push on that, that always gets somebody's back up, and it always seems to exclude somebody out of the circle, whether intended to or not. And it also tends to, and it creates a lot of kind of power relationship sort of stuff, and it tends to forget a lot of people and that kind of thing. On the other hand, I do think on a more pragmatic level, on a working design vocabulary kind of level, yeah, there's plenty of things to learn. There's actually lots of very useful, more ordinary ideas that actually could do a lot of clearing up, you know, that could just help, like, do with a lot of, like, look, this is what this is, you know. If I'm talking about what an object is inside a game, for example, that's something I can actually pretty materially break down to a number of different types of objects and speak very meaningfully about, like, say, the difference between a resource or between a hazard or between a, you know, like an environmental trigger or things that are very, very meat and potatoes like that.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe through doing that, maybe that helps to sort of lessen some of the sting around the larger, more political kind of points that tend to sort of divide the schools of thinking. And maybe so we end up kind of like bouncing our way into a consensus rather than anybody like writing the final essay that actually defines all this kind of stuff.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. No, I agree that no, there's not going to be like someone writes an essay and then boom, we all agree on something. But I do think that, you know, over time, and yeah, maybe it's not in our lifetime, but, you know, it just as a principle, I think it's good to remember that. So anyway, and was there any other sections in your book that you wanted to talk about?
Yeah, so the last part, the last part, and maybe my biggest obsession to an extent, is I very much, over the years that I've been writing design work, I very much have come to the conclusion that game design work in abstract is actually not that valuable unless you can find a way to translate that for a studio to work with, right? So, like, I am a very internal thinker. I think about, like, potential kind of game ideas, and I build, like, personal models all the time of, like, oh, it could be this kind of game, it could be that kind of game, or sort of mentally prototyping myself, all that sort of stuff. But I found, and this is my working experience talking, I found that obviously we know that nobody will read the big game design document. Obviously we know that nobody will follow up on the dense language. If they're not somebody who's already interested in game design, they won't actually know what you're talking about. They won't tell you. They'll just kind of think that they do. You'll get a lot of miscommunication, you'll get a lot of poor stewardship, and you'll get a lot of kind of negative outcomes that sort of come from that. For example, you'll get a kind of triangle of death a lot of the time, where anxiety leads to the will to sort of like over-engineer solutions, which leads to the will to over-spec stuff and kind of back and forth, and which means the studio ends up spending all the money in the world while it's kind of standing still. So the third part of the book, Practices, is all about translations. It's all about what are actually effective design materials? What is what are actually useful ways to like spec out a mechanic, say, for example? What are really useful ways to try and help explain the economy that you see in your mind, but in a way that like your devs will be able to read on half a page and sort of get? What are good practices in terms of writing style? What are good practices in terms of diagramming and wireframing and those kinds of things? What are good practices in terms of the balance between trying to design relationships versus trying to fill them with data? And how should you, at what point of a project should you be doing one over the other, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's very much kind of trying to take that theoretical blob, that like player model, the sense of what the game you're trying to build is, what shape is it going to be, all that sort of stuff. And how do you turn that into sort of bite-sized information that a team can build in, let's say, 2 and 3 week iterations, and you can meaningfully assess, and you can meaningfully change direction on if it's not working, and you can meaningfully like figure out, like try and get your way toward finding to the fun. Because of the hard problem that I mentioned earlier, you'll never be able to fully, completely describe what you're building toward until you sort of see it. So how do you reconcile those two ideas?
Can I ask what's your like actual like background? Like, what did you go to school for, that kind of thing?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I actually went to school twice. By school, you mean university, right?
Sure. Yeah. Or any training that you have is, you know,
back home, it means high school. So I went to university twice. 2 years. Trying to learn to be an engineer.
Hold on. Can you say that one more time? There's something happened with your mic for a second there.
Oh, sure. I went to university when I was very young to try and learn to be an engineer. Like, mm-hmm. I tried to learn how to build bridges and stuff like that. And I was terrible at that. It was possibly the worst choice I ever made in my life. And I failed, and I went off and I got a job for a while and stuff like this. This is when I was about 20, 21. And I was very involved in a burgeoning scene in Ireland at the time around live-action role-playing games.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's actually where I started learning how to design anything at all. Like, I got involved in a convention scene there, where I learned how to build my own board games. I wrote my own RPG scenarios. I kind of constructed my own campaign worlds. And I ran these like 10, 20, 30, 40, and in one case, 75 player kind of LARP board game hybrid crossover games that to this day I still find hard to actually describe to anybody because, I don't know, they were cool, but they were very custom.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went back to university sort of during that time, and I went back and I did a liberal arts degree.
Hmm.
So, which was much more my speed. So I did English literature and I did history. That's where I learned to write, probably.
Gotcha.
And I did that for 4 years while also working in, actually I was working in a game store. I was working in the equivalent of a GameStop for several years as like part-time. So like while the PlayStation launched, I was the guy behind the register selling games to the public and trying to explain what Resident Evil was and mm-hmm. stuff like that. And then I finished uni and I went to work first for a web company in Dublin, just learning how to write courseware. So have you ever done any of these kind of computer-based training courses where, you know, it's say like learning how to use Microsoft Excel or something, and there's mm-hmm. like little characters on the screen and dialogues that point you at stuff, that kind of stuff. So somebody has to write the script for that, and I learned how to write the script for that. And I hated that job, but weirdly, that was the single most influential year that I had in learning how to write game design documentation later on, because it's very structured. It's very formal, you might say.
Mm-hmm.
There's no real room for, because you're literally taking that text, it's going through an editorial layer where they're like evaluating it for grammar and learning and all that, and learning value and all that sort of stuff. And then it's coming back to your studio and it's being translated into production software being a scripting engine. And so like everything has to be really specific and really exact. Right. And then after that, a year later, I went to a friend's wedding and I randomly got a meeting with a guy who ran Havoc, the physics company.
Mm-hmm, I remember them, yeah.
Yeah, well, they're still around, actually. They're
okay, yeah. I just remember when they came out, it was a big deal with the ragdolls and stuff.
Right. So there's an Irish word, well, actually it's an English word as well, which is blag. Which BLAG, which basically means kind of like slightly conning your way in a nice way into something, you know, you blag your way through a conversation.
Uh-huh.
So I went up to this guy and I totally blagged a job off of him.
Nice.
his name is Steve Collins. He's a friend to this day, but I did. I sort of kind of made out that I was really good at writing documentation and all this kind of stuff. And he was like, great, actually, we need a guy to write our manuals. And so I wrote my first kind of official industry job, in a sense, was I wrote the the documentation for the Havok engine for about a year. And then from there, I moved to the UK and I got my first game design job, which was with a studio named Asylum Entertainment. And then, so then it, that kind of, it went from there. I worked in Asylum. I worked at the BBC for a little while. The worst game I ever worked on in my entire life was at the BBC.
Okay.
Which was a game called Fightbox.
Okay.
And if you ever, you want to go find some videos, you'll see the most terrible game you've ever seen in your whole life.
Nice.
And then I went to work for Lionhead for a few years. And I worked, I was a scripting kind of content designer on a game called The Movies.
Mm-hmm. I remember that one.
Right. And then from there, I worked in a couple of other studios and then into the startup. And then I was a consultant for a few years in the UK, somewhat off the back of the blogging and the startup. And then I moved to the US about 4 years ago, and I've been working in the Seattle kind of scene ever since.
Gotcha. Yeah, well, the reason I asked was because, you know, a lot of people in game, like, I feel like there's kind of like two, well, most people in game design, people who are game designers, who think about game design, who care about game design, do tend to come from more STEM sort of side of, you know, and for obvious reasons. But so you mentioned that thing about how, you know, a game design idea can be as good as, you know, it doesn't really matter how good it is if you can't implement it and actually figure out a way to communicate it to people. And I feel like that is an idea that maybe is something that someone from a more STEM background might have to, like, learn, whereas somebody from more of, like, a liberal arts background, it's like, yeah, obviously. I mean, like, that's very you know, like, anyone who's trying to write a good story or make a good song or any kind of, like, you know, creative endeavor understands that, like, you know, something can be as good as you want, but if it can't communicate to people, if it can't connect with people, then it's just, it might as well not exist.
Absolutely.
Right. And yeah. And yeah, so that's something I've been struggling with myself too. Yeah, that's an interesting, so I'm interested. Yeah. I'm looking forward to your book.
Oh, thank you. And so am I. For me, it's the three things in my background that I say, I think you're absolutely right. The three things in my background that really informed that, for me are, I grew up, my parents were big theater people. My mom and dad there's a very, very active amateur theater scene in Ireland, including annual competitions and all this kind of stuff. And it's not just sort of community play kind of stuff. Like, people take it very seriously. There are some very long running theater groups that have, like, histories that go back 50 and 60 and 100 years.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the professional actors who come out of Ireland and go on to become famous, actually, this is where they get their start. A good example is Gabriel Byrne, for instance, got his start as an actor at the Dublin Shakespeare Society, which is an amateur group, semi-amateur group, in Dublin. So, like, my parents were seriously involved in this. So I was actually very involved with, like, theatre stuff from a young age. I did youth drama classes when I was about 15, 16 years old. I was in plays, on stages,
mm-hmm.
That kind of thing. The second thing is, although my first college experience was a disaster, the one thing that it really was a huge benefit for me was I used to hide from classes all the time because I hated it. I cannot emphasize how much I hated it. But I used to hide in our college computer lab all the time, and I discovered Usenet. And on Usenet, I discovered rec.games.frp.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, at the time, actually probably, like, the most vibrant forum for the discussion of kind of games theory, particularly from a tabletop role-playing perspective, because that mm-hmm. was my obsession at the time, in the world. And it's on Rec Games FRP. That's where I learned how to argue, and I learned how to express myself and to, like, sort of really kind of work through ideas and problems, and to discover a whole bunch of ideas around games models, like all that sort of stuff that I'd never really considered before. The vast majority of which, as theory, has subsequently passed into video games,
mm-hmm.
Particularly in the West. It's become the foundation of all MMO theory. It's become the foundation of a lot of, obviously, computer role-playing game theory, but it's also moved into, I mean, again, social games. Most of how the progression loop in social games works is largely lifted out of D&D, you know, mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. So that period, that Usenet period, was key. And then the third one was, I know this sounds weird, but those years that I worked as a retail guy, behind the counter, like, just selling games to people, getting to play games, playing stuff like System Shock, for instance, that kind of stuff, getting to see like what the real world, what humans, if you like, who actually play games, what they're like. Yeah. I consider it a really large accidental education in user experience, in a sense, player experience.
I worked at a GameStop, and I would say the same thing. Yeah.
And so for me, it's those are the foundations of where I kind of learned a lot of how I think. And like the subsequent kind of industry experience that I have had, like, has really helped to sort of flesh that out. But if you're looking for like the sort of the three pillars of TIG, like, that's probably where I begin.
Gotcha. So we got a couple other things I want to hit up before we got to go. So I did want to ask you, like, how would you, cause I've been looking over your stuff. I've read your stuff for a while. But how would you, if someone hasn't read your stuff, like, how would you describe your game design philosophy specifically as opposed to other, you know, like, how do you contrast with other writers? You know, what side of the sort of spectrums would you put yourself on? Say anything about that?
So I would say my perspective comes from, primarily my perspective comes from what I would say. Let me answer that again, sorry. Primarily my perspective comes from sort of player experience. Like, one of the biggest revelations that I had working on games somewhere around about 2007, 2008, is that a lot of the internal systems, a lot of what the British would call the gubbins of how games work, don't really matter at all from the point of view of a player. Like, a player sees a game as a thing on a screen. They have a controller. They're essentially almost like a driver of a car or something like that, or the pilot of a drone. And their experience is very much that physical to that visual to that audio back. It's a principle in my book. I call it see, hear, do. Like, to a player, everything is see, hear, do. Everything is either something that they've noticed, something that, like, they can hear around the corner, or some action that they can take. And then the consequences that sort of come out of that need to play back into see, hear, do kind of over and over. And if a game doesn't do that, or if it does it in a way that's hard to understand, or where, if you like, where, I mean, a good example is things like where, I love procedural generation, but I sometimes see procedural generation used as an excuse for not wanting to figure out how a game is supposed to be played. It's just, oh, there's all this stuff in there. You can just kind of play with it, discover it for yourself kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That to me is that's the point of where the developer of that game has kind of forgotten that a player is actually supposed to, like, interface with this thing. Mm-hmm. So a huge amount of my thinking, whether it's for story or simulation or behavioral stuff or just the pure, like, skill mechanics or whatever, huge amount of my thinking will tend to stem from, is a player able to relate to this? Are they going to understand it? Is it just complication for complication's sake? Fundamentally, like, is there value there, you know? And and then sort of following on from that, it's like, is that sustainable? So there's a term that I use sometimes, saying, is a game, when I'm talking to clients, is a game extensible? And by that, I mean, you play Doom, for instance, right? You got a character, picks up a pistol, later he picks up a shotgun, later he picks up a rocket launcher, later he customizes the rocket launcher, whatever. Like, that's that root weapon mechanism is being extended again and again and again and again and again. And it's a lot of what keeps the game very interesting. Like, it keeps the game very fascinating and all that sort of stuff. And what you see with a lot of kind of failing game designs is that they just don't extend well. Like, maybe they want to try and do so via an emergent pattern, a la chess, but a lot of the time they don't. And so a lot of the time they're just repetitive. So that's kind of those two things. And then my third thing, which tends to get me into trouble with certain good friends of mine, is I tend to believe in the power of single-player games. And I think that, because, you know, there is a lot of designers who believe that single-player is kind of a temporary phase, or that it's something that, if you like, games, it's almost like a holdover of the past, or that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas my view is, I think single-player games, like, are among the purest form of video game. And
I agree with you, actually. I'm on your side about that. Yep.
Right. And I just do because, for two reasons. One, every time I've seen, and I've worked on a bunch of games that have attempted to square the multiplayer sort of circle. Every time I've seen games that are reliant purely on multiplayer, I see a pattern where a lot of initial users fall out of them very quickly. Because things like the skill level of other players means they have a losing experience quite a lot, which means who really wants to put their head in that line, kind of, you know, over and over and over just to get sort of semi-good. You will immediately reject something like 90% of potential players if you've only got a multiplayer kind of basis. And the second one is that I think it's about how it's actually video games kind of great innovation. It's figuring out how to make a game that goes beyond requiring other people or goes beyond needing everybody to sit around a table or that kind of thing. Like the video game experience. I just started playing the new Zelda game on Nintendo Switch. Mm-hmm. And I'm very excited for it. And I love the fact that it's a portable system and I can put it on my TV and all that sort of stuff. But really what it is that like my life works in a certain way and I need my gaming media to work in a certain way around me. And like the same, that's the same as true for books, or it's the same as true for listening to music or watching TV or those kinds of things. And so the personal meat of the system experience of the game is actually a huge part of what makes video game design special over and above table game design or live action game design or sports or all of those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And I think that as a culture, I think game developers and game designers tend to be too quick to want to sort of go past it in the belief that there's a future beyond what's supposed to be there, you know?
That's interesting. It's funny because I agree that single player games are, I would say that they're like ideal, and particularly even for strategy games. I think like something like Zelda, or something like that's story based, it's kind of a little bit more intuitive why single player would be better for that. But for strategy games, or, you know, I actually think the ideal setup for a strategy game is a single player thing, which I think probably for different reasons than what you are giving. I think your reasons make sense as well, but that's interesting that we come to the similar conclusions probably for totally different reasons.
I mean, in the end of the day, a lot of what we're doing as game developers is we're trying to provide players with a better time than life is, and like the, because otherwise why, like just like a, or no, not just like a writer, because then that sounds like I'm just talking about narratives, but what I mean is like we're trying to create entertainment for people. We're trying to create something that they want to sort of engage with because they want to, not because they have to or that kind of thing. And there's nothing at all wrong with saying for some players that's, you know, an e-sport, or for some players that's an MMO, for some players that's Tetris, or for some players that's Candy Crush, or any of the sort of million and one sort of potential kind of games that come sort of in between. I mean, in the end of the day, and this goes back to my original, almost my first episode, post on what games are many years ago. It comes back to, I think, trying to deliver what I call a thematic experience. It's something that kind of goes beyond just the meat and potatoes of I'm doing an activity to spend some time. Something where I'm looking into the screen of the game and something special is happening, whether I believe in it or not, or whether it's kind of fully capturing me or not, or that kind of thing. But it's a special out of normality sort of experience. I think the power of games as an art form a lot of the time comes from that sort of unique relationship. And so like my ultimate goal always, whether I'm designing or whether I'm helping somebody else or critiquing or writing about stuff, is probably I'm always trying to help people make that thematic experience happen. So that's what I do.
Well, that leads into my I think the last thing that I'll end on, which is I am a VR/AR skeptic. And so I wanted to hear about why you, let me give you my spiel as really quickly on why I'm a skeptical of those things. So obviously I wouldn't say that you can't make a great game that's in VR. I mean, but my thing is that I don't see the value that adds, because in my opinion, the interestingness of an action comes really ultimately from its rules and from its the actual interactions, and that the aesthetics tend to pretty much, like, as long as they're clear enough and they're not getting in the way, once you are, you know, in that, like, I guess people like to say flow state, or once you're like in it and you're actually interacting in the way that it's supposed to work and you know how it works and you're there, all that stuff kind of like just melts away. And you know, the fact that it's encompassing your vision, or if it's just like some cards on a table, it seems to me to not really matter at all. And so my concern with VR and all that kind of stuff is that people will kind of think that it's like, oh, wow, great. Instead of having to actually do the hard work of design, now I can just, like, you know, put someone in a virtual world and my job is done, sort of.
Of course, of course. So the two things that I'd sort of say there is, well, actually, let me ask you a question first. How much VR have you actually played?
A small amount, not zero, but a small amount.
Okay. So So I'm going to sound a bit evangelical here for a moment, but bear with me. There's a newness to the modality, if you like, of virtual reality that's not the same. It's not like it's not an extended version of screen gaming. So now, in fairness, there are some games that are essentially extended screen games that put they're in a VR headset, but it's fundamentally quite a different feeling to put on a headset, get into VR, try and play a game in VR, and whether you're having a really great experience or not, it's operating by different rules compared to what you might be used to from other games. And that's not a new thing in terms of any kind of big movement in the games industry. So like when mobile came along, for example, there were a lot of people for a couple of years with smartphone gaming that were pretty skeptical of it. People who maybe come from what they perceived as richer formats like handheld gaming development or that kind of thing. And it took them a long time to get their head around the idea that maybe mobile gaming might actually work or that kind of thing. There's always, when you get a big paradigm shift like this, there's always like a lot of, we talked about it earlier, the change of language, the change of kind of idea, the change of, you know, what's your kind of accepted precepts about what this is and why it works and that kind of thing. And that is very much true for VR. A simple example is, have you played the PC version of Superhot?
Yes, I have.
Okay. Have you played the VR version of Superhot?
No, I have not.
Okay, so the PC version of Superhot for me is an interesting game of the kind of dual-cylinder first-person shooter kind of variety. Like your character control is essentially, well, your bottom cylinder moves, your top cylinder aims, and your dodging is a sort of a left-right sort of affair, just trying to like anticipate paths ahead of time. Right? And it's a great game, don't get me wrong, it's a really, really, really good game. The VR version of Superhot is not at all the same, because it's a room scale game. And what that means is your actual physical body dodging is different to the cylinder style dodging of Superhot for PC. So when you duck around a bullet shot, for example, and you're coming up with your gun in your right hand to try and make a shot, that physical body position that you're adopting is not something you can do in the PC version of the game at all. So it's fundamentally different.
Well, couldn't you just couldn't there be a function for that coded in the PC version via mouse control or something?
It would not be the same. It's the what I'm trying to get at is there's a certain level of physical one-to-oneness, a certain level of what's that term that Steve Swink always uses? I'm blanking on it at the moment. Proprioception. There's a certain level of proprioception that VR games just intuitively bring to you that you do not get and you'll never, ever, ever get from kind of a screen gaming sort of environment. And independent of how the industry is going or how many headsets are being sold or like all of the meat and potatoes kind of concerns, that's something that designers should be paying attention to, because it's just not the same. It's a new thing. It's a new set of verbs. It's a new set of it's a totally different structure for what seems to make a successful game in that space. And a totally different approach around a lot of things like, say, attention or direction or a lot of, assumed stuff. Another one would be like duration of play session. Like how long can you realistically expect someone to stay in a VR game? Might be a lot shorter because it's much more physically active, like that kind of thing. But it's interesting is my point. It's just interesting compared to the relative sort of slowdown that has happened with a lot of other formats.
Take something like a light gun game, one of those old things, or back in the NES days and the Super Nintendo days, there were a lot of those kind of like peripherals. U-Force was one that I remember, but there was all kinds of those sort of things. The Power Glove, the Wiimote actually even sort of is like that. Yep. Would you, if now I would definitely accept, like, because it is true that the Wiimote meets the criteria that you were just kind of talking about, that there's stuff you can do with the Wiimote and that just would not be the same without the Wiimote. And so I'm just trying to, is that kind of the level of claim that you're making about VR, or is that?
Yeah. It's very much in that sort of, a light gun game, for example, would be, I used to love playing Time Crisis in the arcade. And the way back when, and in that game, obviously you have the gun, you're aiming at opponents on the screen, and you have the pedal, and when you take your foot off the pedal, I think it was, that's when you dodge.
I remember what you're talking about. Yeah.
You'd have like decent aiming, but fairly crude dodge, like as a sort of a setup, right? Whereas if you play Space Pirate Trainer, you have really decent aiming, maybe a little less so, because long aiming perspective in VR is actually a little harder than it seems to be, because your eyes actually don't resolve fully 3D space as well in virtual reality as you think they will. But nonetheless, it's serviceable. But the dodging aspect of that game is completely different. You have a lot of physicality that's involved, because literally, like, you can be a bullet can be coming at you, and you can literally take a step to the left, duck down, turn around, put up a shield behind you. You can literally be holding your hand behind you. You can't even see it, but you know you've got your shield up as a kind of a cover for the ships that you're kind of fairly sure are behind you. And you have an awareness of three-dimensional space around you that's not necessary when you're playing something like Time Crisis. And so, like, the kinds of skill challenge that are involved might sort of on a surface level, they might seem the same, but actually they're very different. And that's kind of part of it. You know, like, there's at a root mechanical level, at a gameplay level, that is that's sort of kind of the nub of why it's actually quite interesting as a sort of game paradigm, platform, whatever, compared to other stuff. Now, does that mean it's fully explored? Absolutely not. Does that mean that you'll see a lot of developers making games that, as you say, are just kind of like, put it in VR? Yeah, sure, of course you will. I mean, it's a new format. You see a lot of that with any new format. Does that mean that there's a lot of sameness to certain games? Possibly. Things like the difficulty with locomotion has led to a lot of games where, you know, the game is actually essentially set in a room and you're kind of exploring the room kind of all the time. But hang on.
Yeah.
But if you the game you want to play, I would really recommend, if you can, get a hold of Alchemy's recent Rick and Morty game, the virtuality Rick and Mortality game. I don't think that's the right name, but you know the one I mean. And there's a segment in that game where, I don't want to spoil it too much, but there's a segment in that game where you're doing a lot of kind of find a wrench to put in a hole, find a hole to put in a wrench, combine two things to make an apple to get a thing. It's very puzzle sort of based. It's very task driven. But there's a part in that game where you activate a little arcade game and you go into it and you suddenly find yourself in a sort of a long kind of story section where you're kind of like role-playing through a life kind of stuff. And it's really weird how effective it is. It's very, very similar in some respects to what some other games have done in the past, but it's actually very different at the same time. So try it and you'll sort of see.
Yeah, I do need to try VR more, and I will definitely admit that up front. I guess for me, there's two issues. One is that, you know, I feel like the amount of stress that's put on it, it seems like it's more than, oh, just this neat thing to explore. A lot of people seem to think, like, this is the way of the future, and this is like, and I think a big reason for that is that since the beginning, there's been this strain in video game design, more than a strain, the basic, like, backbone of game design aesthetic philosophy has been fantasy simulation. That we are entering a fantasy world, and that's actually, like, a philosophy that I kind of, like, oppose and think is not the way to think about game design. I tend to think that, you know, game design, there we do need to use, like, metaphors in order to give the player affordances and stuff. So I'm not saying, like, everything should just be, like, you know, circles and rectangles and, you know, purely abstract, but the idea of that we should be representing, like, as close as possible a real or realistic space is extremely limiting for game designers. I mean, that's one of the most, like, slowing factors in the growth of game design is this idea that, you know, by default, games are a virtual world that you run around in and, you know, fight monsters. And there's all this stuff, this baggage that comes with that kind of thing. Whereas, you know, if you actually break out of that and think, like, maybe it could be a little bit like that, but maybe it's also got really abstract elements that are totally weird and look more to the way that board game designers, I mean, because board game designers, I think the reason that they've done, I don't know if you agree with me, but I think, you know, the last 15, 20 years of board game design, the designer Euro game, that whole world, those people have, like, really tapped into something in terms of, like, I just think that they're the best game designers, some of the best game designers on the planet. And the reason I think that is because they never had a chance to do realistic fantasy simulation, really. So they were forced to look somewhere else. And I think that somewhere else that they looked was actual interactive systems design that's like just concerned with interactive merit. And so my concern with the VR, just to push against it once more time, is that it's sort of, it seems like it's, you know, at a time when I wish that we would move more away from that fantasy simulation thinking, I feel like it's just going to pull everyone really back into that again. And even though, I mean, I'm not saying, I don't think that's true of like you and or other people like yourself who are like, you know, really very thoughtful game design writers, game design thinker type people. But I think by and large, it's just going to pull the gravity of general game thinking and game design philosophy, the center, the you know, the Overton window or whatever of game design philosophy. It's going to pull it in the direction of fantasy simulation. What do you think of that?
So I well, actually, yeah, I agree with your thesis. I absolutely think that a huge amount of VR projects that are kind of in workings at the moment, a lot of them are very experience based, and yes, a lot of them are trying to create, whether it's a fantasy or a horror project, or particularly there's a lot of people trying to figure out how to make scary VR games and stuff, and that's like quite terrifying and that kind of thing. And I think that you will definitely see an advance more in aesthetic literacy at first. What I mean by that particularly is, like, it's easier, I think, for aesthetic innovation to occur within the space, whereas mechanical literacy, like people understanding complex game ideas or complex systems kind of within the VR space, that I feel is going to take a lot longer to fully manifest. And I think a lot of that is because for many users, they don't actually have as much familiarity with the base controls and the base uses of the system as they may have with other systems. And so, like, the kinds of mechanics, if you like, that will pass muster for a long period of time may actually seem quite relatively simple. I mean, shooting games, easy sort of stand and shoot stuff games, is almost like going back to arcades of the early 80s in some respects. But it's almost, I view that as necessary. I don't think you're going to be able to teach a VR video game player how to play a very abstract sort of set of puzzle or something like that for a while. But the second part of it is, it goes back a little bit to what I said about see, hear, do earlier. One of my big revelations many years ago was I realized that if players couldn't understand what they were seeing, then it makes it very difficult for a game to actually be a success. And the thing that has to be acknowledged within that is, and we see this all the time in screen gaming already, is there's a lensing effect that comes through by virtue of the fact that a game is at one remove from a player, where players frequently don't actually understand the under system, if you like, that they're observing. They get a much more heuristic understanding of what they think they're doing. Mm-hmm. They don't understand, they don't actually perceive balance and fairness in the same way as board game players do. Board game player, you know, you're sitting there, you're playing D.C. Adler on Catan, say, or Settlers, sorry, and, like, it's everything's exposed. Everything is there. You can see how everything works. You can see how the operations work. And so you're completely, you have a lot of faith that the game itself is fair and just and simple and really just like a test of your intelligence to figure out. I see this so much with video games where people infer elaborate fictions for what they're actually seeing on the screen because they don't have that confidence in information. They don't have total perspective. And even in VR, that's true. Like there's a level of almost offstage kind of effect that's always seems to be at play within a digital gaming experience. And I've come to believe over the years that somewhat reduces the amount of space that a designer may have to create like amazing but like pretty complicated mechanics a la German board games. Right. I think that it's a weakness of the form to an extent, but it's also a strength of the form that elaborate fiction building kind of exists in a way that's actually stronger than you see in a lot of other kind of games. So I don't know, we may never be able to get fully to the perfect place that you're envisioning, but I do feel that it's not necessarily a net negative, but I think the designers should be ready. If they're going to get into VR, I think they should be ready to expect the library of mechanics that they want to work with to be on the simpler side for a while the audience kind of catches up.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, part of me is almost like, can we just not have more technical innovation? Can there just be like this brick wall that like just stops right. us in place so that we can start looking towards more aesthetic innovation and more, you know, theoretical innovation?
Right.
Because that's what happened with board games. I mean, board games, you know, they're the same materials since, well, forever. Right. So, yeah.
I mean, that's a fair point. Maybe it is, but I mean, I don't know. There's with the VR crowd, there's already a whole new crowd behind them, which is the AR crowd, who are working in even more hypothetical terms. But there's a lot of kind of just buzz going on around how that might work and what that might mean and how real world and virtual world kind of interactions might work. And so I don't know. I think you're probably going to find for a long time to come the pace of technical development and platform development is not likely to slow down significantly.
Yeah, no, I know.
So we're just going to be, it's you know, it's what we're doing. It's how
we work. Yeah. All right, great. Well, is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we get going?
No, I think that's it.
All right.
That was a really good conversation.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. And I look forward to your book. And I also look forward to whatgamesare.com coming back into the fray.
Indeed, indeed. We will get there, believe me.
All right, awesome. Well, thank you again so much for coming on.
Okay, thanks so much, Keith.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.